this is where it's at. This is how you truly grow generational wealth. Because yeah, can you go make a few hundred thousand or whatever, a million through maybe crypto? But just like anybody else who wins the lottery, what are you going to do with that afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
Just because you got had this lucky streak, or you may have put a few $1,000 into something and it multiplied. Okay, what's your plan after that? And most people don't have a plan after that. You know, they're working and they're just hoping, right? They're hoping, and that's not investing either.
Welcome to the Rich Drummers Report, where we talk real estate, business, and wealth building, all while keeping it real. No fluff, no BS. I hope that you enjoy the show. All right, guys, welcome to another episode of The Reports. Today, we got a special guest who flew in from Arizona, and this man specializes in investing in assisted living facilities. Today, I got none other than Serge Lupescu. Serge, welcome to the show, my man.
What's going on, brother? Appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
excited for this and excited for everybody to hear what we got going on.
Man, I'm excited for this conversation today. I've been learning a little bit about you on YouTube, and I know a little bit about your story, but for the listeners out there that aren't familiar, tell us a little bit about what you were doing before real estate and what you're doing today, man.
Yeah, great question. So I went and majored in nursing and graduated nursing school in 2017. During my period of going through nursing school, I was working in the ICU as a CNA and just was doing a lot of bedside work. And I realized pretty quickly after working with a bunch of nurses and talking to them that that was not what I wanted to do after I graduated. So I said, well, let me take this degree that I just worked so hard for and see what I can do with it. And so I ended up moving to Arizona in 2018 and started my own facility in Mesa, Arizona. And it was a small facility. It was 5 beds. And that's how I got into the whole niche of assisted living.
There's so much to unpack there. What was it about the assisted living facility that first intrigued you? Because most people, when they get into real estate investing, myself included, they think about single family, or they think about Airbnb, they think about small multifamily, but not a lot goes straight into assisted facilities.
And that's the thing. It wasn't saturated, and it still isn't to this day. Like, it's still something that a lot of people just got to have a heart for. And taking care of elderly and other people's families is a hard thing to do. And because I already had that nursing background, it was just something that flowed very easily for me. And I'm like, I already have this medical background. And so my first facility, I actually leased it. I didn't even buy it. And I realized that concept and that model could actually work, but it just didn't click to me then. And then that's when I fast forward, I ended up, was like, well, let me figure out how I can get into real estate. And that's when I bought a short-term rental, right? To your point. Like, I'm like, oh, let me do short-term rental. And one of my cousins was doing rental arbitrage, which you're very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going really well for him. And I said, well, if it's working out for him, let me get into the whole Airbnb game too. And that's how I got, that was like my very first deal. But I was still running my facility at the time. And it only clicked after I met my now business partner that, why don't I just buy these places and lease them to operators like myself?
Mm.
And that's kind of how I got into that.
So what exactly is an assisted living facility?
Yeah, so the big thing, it's essentially called residential assisted living. Here in the state of California, it's called like residential care facility for the elderly. So RSFEs. But essentially, it's a single family home that ends up being converted, adding additional bedrooms, adding a sprinkler system, fire panel, a bigger meter, essentially, and then getting it zoned for R4. And being able to run in a facility out of it. And then you get licensed through the state board, which is like the regulatory board. So each state has their own regulatory board for this specific type of business. So you actually eventually get your facility licensed once you get it zoned and converted.
How much can an assisted living facility generate? Let's say, for example, you alluded to a 6-bedroom single family home. What can a 6-bedroom home generate?
So yeah, it can generate, I mean, my in-laws actually do it, surprisingly, here in California. So each state's different on how many beds you can license in a residential setting. Here in California, it's 6 beds. In Arizona, it's 10 beds. Texas, you can go up to 16 beds.
Wow.
Florida, it's 6 beds. But on a 6-bed, on average, you're netting anywhere from $7,000 to $8,000 a month. And that's after paying your staff, all the supplies, et cetera.
What about
and
gross?
And that's on a 6-bed. Gross, you're probably looking at $35,000-$40,000.
Okay. I can imagine the operations when you get into these facilities can be very hands-on, if you would. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the operations.
Yeah, the operations is something that a lot of people kind of underestimate and don't realize. We do see a lot of investors come into this space thinking that they could just buy something that's turnkey, that's already operating, has residents, has a manager, has caregivers, and think that they don't have to have any type of involvement. But the reality is there's a lot that goes into operating these places, just like any other business operation. But if you're the manager, like what happens a lot of times is there's a lot of owner occupants, right? You see it in the boutique hotel model as well. But a lot of these care home owners essentially try to do all the work themselves. They try to do all the caregiving. They try to do all the cooking. They try to do all the supply runs, all the medication administration. And it can be a lot of work. And that's what I did in the beginning. I did all of that for the first year and it was really hard. And that's what typically the operations looks like. You got to do the tours, right? With the families, you got to place those residents. You got to do the admissions. Stuff happens. You got to send them off to the hospital, right? And then you got to follow up with the hospitals. You got to work with the hospices, the home health. So there is a lot of nuances that goes into the operations, but a lot of people, if they're looking to get into this space, it's like really having that genuine heart to care for people, because it's going to take a lot to do it.
It almost sounds like it's a lot more workload intensive than having a portfolio of short-term rentals.
Yeah. So like the portfolio I have now, it's strictly just leasing to operators. So our operators, they're the ones that are operating the businesses. I don't have any say in what they do with their operations as far as how they choose to market, what type of staff they choose to hire, none of that. So for me, it's a lot more passive in that sense. But my whole intention is to make sure they find the property that they could actually operate out of, because that's kind of a bottleneck in this industry and starting this type of operation, is finding the right property to convert that can be zoned. And secondly, that it has the great layout that it needs to have to be successful.
So if I go out and buy a 10-bedroom home in Arizona somewhere, and I want to convert it, what exactly do I need to do in order to get the proper zoning required?
Yeah. So the first thing is checking that it can even be zoned to be like, so they all in the state of Arizona and other places, they put this regulation in place, this rule in place about 4 years ago, or even longer than that. But they really started to crack down, kind of like short-term rentals are kind of dealing with now, but they all have to be about 1,400 square feet apart from each other. So a quarter mile, essentially. So if it's not a quarter mile apart from another facility, you most likely cannot zone it. But there is a way around that by getting a special accommodation. So you can, and it's essentially getting a variance for that property. And so you can get that. It takes a little bit more work. But essentially what you would have to do is just make sure that, okay, it meets that zoning spacing requirement. And then if it doesn't have a sprinkler system and a fire panel, you'll most likely have to install that. And that typically requires also increasing the meter as well to make sure you have enough pressure for that sprinkler system.
Okay.
So with that, that is what essentially would be the first step, is getting zoned. And then secondly, once you get it zoned, if you choose to, you can get it licensed, because there is a lot of value there too, if you can license it. But if you have a 10-bedroom home, you'd get a license of 10 beds, most likely.
How much ballpark would it cost to get one of these properties zoned and converted? Because are you supplying the beds and all that and the furnishings, or is the operator doing that?
Yeah, so all of that is pretty much the operator. A lot of the stuff that I've bought up to date has been, for the most part, either converted already, and it's just one of these operators who is just failing or burnt out, and they'll just sell off all the furniture and equipment. And so typically we'll subsidize that into the valuation of the real estate, and then just have the operator essentially pay us for the business. So we sell that off separately. But typically what you'll see, I mean, to cost to convert and then get this place furnished and everything, anywhere from about $150,000 to $250,000. And that's to, you know, get every, if you're adding additional bedrooms, bathrooms, also to get the fire sprinkler system, all that put in place. Yeah, it's about that price point.
What makes an ideal property in Arizona? Let's say if you were going to go hand select the most ideal property to operate as an assisted living facility, what makes that property ideal?
Single level.
Okay.
Yeah. I know it's a very obvious thing, but a lot of people always ask me.
Which most properties in Arizona are single level,
they
right?
They are. Yeah. Okay. Single level, you want to get licensed for as many beds as possible. So if you can get a home that's over 2,500 square feet, up to, you know, 3,500 or 4,000 square feet and be able to force some of that appreciation by adding value by getting more bedrooms in there, whether it's converting a garage or, you know, attaching maybe a guest house to the main property and adding those additional bedrooms. But if you can make as many bedrooms as possible, that's what you want. If you can make them all private bedrooms, and I wouldn't focus as much on the bathrooms because the bathrooms, they'll typically share them. And most people in these types of homes are like in wheelchairs or bed bound, or, you know, they're not utilizing the showers as much. So I wouldn't go all out and do 10 bedrooms, 10 bathrooms necessarily, but I'd probably do about a 10 bedroom, 5-6 bathroom home would be the ideal property.
And you mentioned guest house. So if you have a guest house, can you theoretically put 10 beds in the main house and 10 beds in the guest house?
No, you would need to subdivide it. It would need to be a separate.
So you would have to split the lot, but then now you're dealing with being less than X amount of miles from one another, right?
So that's a very interesting take. So because we purchased the property and it's essentially an 8-bed that's licensed for 8 beds. And the next house over, like the lot over, is a 10-bed and it's all private 10 bedrooms, 10 bath. The one that's an 8-bed is like 6 bedrooms, 3 baths. So they're next to each other. The nice thing about that one, it got grandfathered in into the zoning. So, but now, yes, theoretically, it wouldn't meet the spacing requirement.
Okay.
In that sense.
Interesting. And I got to imagine with all the baby boomers retiring and that big wave of people, you know, kind of getting to that age to where they're going to start going into retirement homes, the demand for this product has got to be relatively high. Is it trending up or is it trending down right now?
During COVID, it was very interesting. It just kind of became stale and there wasn't a lot of people. A lot of families were worried. They were kind of like trying to figure it out, just like anybody else was during that period. But now it's starting to trend up upward a lot because what had happened during COVID, all these big box facilities all got COVID, all of them. And the percentage of homes that got COVID and people, you know, unfortunately passing was very minor compared to the big box facility. So families started realizing we need to get into these smaller contained areas, essentially in these smaller homes. And so, yeah, you're starting to see a lot more traffic come to the smaller residential.
And the reason behind that is, or the logic behind that is, you're saying these smaller properties with only 10 beds, they weren't getting the COVID because there was just less people coming in and out. Is that
correct? Yeah. Okay. You're able to contain it a lot better. You could let certain guests come in if you chose to, you know, the different third-party services like hospice or home health, anybody that was treating any of the people at the home, you could, you know, each person would have to come through and just like any other facility, you would have to fill out, make sure you got their temperature, et cetera. So you were able to really contain that a lot better on the smaller.
Can you charge a lot more for a bed if you have a lot of luxury amenities on your property? Maybe you have a lake, maybe you have, you know, a pickleball court. I don't know if these folks at that age play pickleball, but, you guys would be surprised, man. Hey. I've played pickleball against like a 75-year-old lady with a torn ACL and she whooped my ass. So, they're out there.
Dude, I was mountain biking and there was a lady, she had to be in her 60s, bro. And she was just going at it. She passed me up and I was like, damn. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. So anyhow, if you have these amenities and you have like a really nice resort style property, can you charge more per bed? Hey guys, real quick, I hope that you're finding value in this show. If you could do me a huge favor and drop a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you're listening on, it would mean the world to me. Also, if you know of anyone that would potentially benefit from this podcast, feel free to share it with them so we can help more people build wealth through real estate investing. Now back to the show.
So I love that you're asking that because I know you have a Scottsdale property. And I have operators who have Paradise Valley assisted livings.
Okay.
And they're charging just because of, again, to your point with those amenities, walkways are really important. If you could have a nice big backyard with a nice walkway where they can go out with family, go for a walk, whatever, a nice gazebo, for instance, a fire pit, stuff like that. If you have the room to do that, yes, you'll be able to charge a lot more because of those amenities. I'll give you an example. One of my operators, he actually charges on average $7,000 to $8,000 a bed.
Okay.
And that's in Paradise Valley.
And what's the range typically for properties out there in that area?
Price-wise?
Low-end, high-end per bed, yeah.
Per bed, yeah. Low-end, I would say the average right now is about $3,500. On the high-end, you're probably looking at like $7,000 to $8,000.
Okay. Are there operators that will put 2 beds in 1 room?
Yes. So there is a requirement for that. It has to meet. So each individual need to have 60 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that essentially you need to have a room that's 120 square feet to put two beds in. But that's the max. You can't, if you have, let's say 180 square feet, you can't put three beds in there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Two shared.
So I know most recently you guys took down a boutique hotel out in Tucson, Arizona. And you guys converted this over to an assisted living facility. Talk a little bit about that deal, how it come to fruition, and talk about your business plan there.
Yeah, so that one we actually, so yeah, it was a Red Rock Inn is what it was called. And it was actually right next to a boutique hotel. And that one we're actually converting into a behavioral health facility. So this is like another type of license, essentially, within this like healthcare niche of facilities. And that one came to fruition. We had an operator who was leasing another 20-bed facility in Phoenix from us. And he was growing his operations down in Tucson. And he was essentially like, hey, I need a facility. Like, there's nothing really on the market. And we were like, whoa, what if we came across something that we could convert? And it had to be all interior. So no exterior entrances, like a lot of those motels and stuff down there are. And we came across this one. And we toured it and we're like, well, this could actually work. We could actually take the front area, which is the lobby, and then the manager's office. And as we were walking in, kind of looking at it, we're like, I think this actually could work. And so we ran it by our state regulatory board of Arizona DHS and, hey, would something like this actually, would we be able to license it? That was like the first thing we wanted to ask. Like, yeah, you guys could. So from there, we decided, okay, well, how would we go about licensing? Because it's two stores. So it's 42 bedrooms. The first floor, I believe it's 22 bedrooms. And then the second floor is 21. Yeah, 20 or 21. Yeah, it's 20 up on the second floor. So we're like, what are we going to do with the second floor? Like, we could either just reconfigure it, make it a bunch of offices, or, you know, for the staff that would be there on site. But we were essentially, well, we need transitional housing. And that's what we ended up. And you don't need to license that. So the first floor of that hotel will be for behavioral health. And then
What is behavioral health? What's the difference?
The difference is actually age. So we're servicing people from 25 to 55, 65 even. And it's people dealing with mental illness, substance and abuse, any type of all that stuff. Like, all of it combined essentially is behavioral health. So they get treated and then they essentially go to a behavioral health facility, go through a 90-day program. And then once they go through a 90-day program, what happens typically is they just kind of get not thrown out into the street, but kind of like go figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
So with the transitional component, what we're going to be able to do is actually give them housing, get them back on their feet, provide them with a job locally, right? And then from there, once they get on their feet, they can go get their own apartment essentially, or they can choose to stay. That's what our next deal, which is the 20-unit apartment complex, they could either just choose to stay there and lease from us directly.
Okay. So upstairs, are you guys doing the behavioral health as well, or is it assisted living?
So there's no assisted living at all.
At all. Okay, gotcha.
This will just be behavioral health. So it's essentially called behavioral health residential facility. That's what the license is called. And then the second floor will just be transitional housing once they go through the program on the behavioral component.
Gotcha. So just curious, what did you guys pay for that property? And then what are you guys leasing that out for in terms of a monthly perspective?
Yeah. So we pay 2.6, so just under 65,000 a door. And then we're putting about 700,000 into it. So we'll be around 3.3, 3.4 all in. And we actually secured a triple net lease at 40K a month for 10 years.
Wow. And so for the listener out there, triple net means what exactly?
Yeah. So triple net, essentially the operator or the tenant is going to cover all maintenance, all property insurance and property taxes on that one. And the nice thing is Tucson. So for all the listeners, I would say like that's why it's really good to know your market because we were able to actually get this like tax exemption because we're a healthcare facility. And so what we're going to be paying or what our operator essentially is going to be paying in taxes is not going to be anywhere what we were expecting. So I forget the exact numbers of how much he was supposed to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And because we ended up just confirming with the city, like, hey, this is what this is going to be. Like, how much are we going to have to pay in taxes, et cetera? Like, what is our payment schedule going to look like? And they're like, oh, well, actually, because it's going to be a health facility, you guys get this exemption. And we're like, whoa.
Whoa. Really?
That's going to save our operator a ton of money. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then how many years was this lease?
For 10 years.
Wow. Yeah. With step-up payments and all that?
Correct, yeah. With annual increases. And then, yeah, he's got a five-year renewal if he chooses.
How do you guys get lending for a hotel like this that you're going to lease out to a behavioral operator?
So yeah, this one we worked, so we had a really great relationship with one of our lenders that we did, I think it was like 6 or 7 facilities already. And they knew our model. They actually lended on our facility that we were leasing to this operator already in Phoenix, the 20 bed.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew him. They knew his financials. We had already vetted him. So it was a pretty smooth transition, like coming to them. They kind of were a little bit hesitant, like, whoa, you guys are taking this big project on and you guys are going to actually be doing a full conversion here, because it wasn't anything like we did before, where it was already probably zoned or licensed. So they took a risk on us. They said, all right, we trust you guys. You guys have done well now. You guys are bringing this solid operator who's very liquid and has a great operation in place. So yeah, that's... It was a relationship based.
So did you already have this lease agreement kind of in place with the operator and they underwrote the operator as well? I mean, you mentioned they looked at his liquidity.
Yeah. So what we do with each of our deals, we kind of work backwards. We always find the operator first, vet them. During our due diligence period, we actually get that lease signed with our operator.
That's smart.
And then when we go to the bank, right? Yeah. They give us kind of like that pre-approval, like, sure, you know, we'll go ahead and send off this pre-approval letter on your guys' behalf, but you know, you guys know the deal, like make sure you're... And so they underwrite, yeah, based off of the lease that we have in place already with the tenant.
For a listener out there that is interested in getting into their first assisted living facility, and maybe they have a little bit of capital they're working with, maybe they have a small track record investing into other real estate assets, how would you recommend one get started if they don't know much about it?
On the real estate investing side?
On the assisted living facility side.
Okay. Like operations is what you're asking.
Not just operations, but to buy one, right? Yeah. They want to go buy their first one and then maybe they want to lease it out to an operator.
Yeah. I would for sure get to know the market you want to be in, because this is such a niche specific like thing in real estate. And you do need to know your operators well, because honestly, there's so much opportunity here and there's a lot of operators that want to lease, but there's not a lot of landlords willing to convert their properties and put in the money to do it, right? Why would I take a single family home that I've been short-term renting or whatever and convert it to lease it out to an operator on a five-year lease? So there is that opportunity. But what I would recommend is, yeah, get to know your market first and get in a state where it's going to be like landlord-friendly, but also where you can get the most beds out of a certain property, right? So like, for instance, like I said, Arizona and Texas is where you're able to get the most licensed beds out of all the states. And so that's where I would focus on. Like I would focus on Texas and Arizona, because even Washington State, Oregon, those are popular states for this model. But you can only get licensed for 6 beds, including California. And not only that, but real estate prices too, right? Even though Texas and Arizona have just skyrocketed, it's hard to find something where you can possibly get. But the nice thing is you can have a 6-bedroom home, a 3-bath, 6-3, and you can license it for 10 beds, right? If the rooms are big enough. Mm-hmm. So if I was somebody new, that's what I would kind of just focus on, is the markets that this business model works really well in. Florida is a lot more affordable, but again, Florida, you can only really license up to 6 beds.
Up to 6. But it sounds like Texas is a great play because one, it's got warm weather, mm-hmm. Generally speaking. 2, there's no state income tax. So,
correct.
You know, great place to retire. But then 3, you can go up to, is it 16 or 18 beds?
16 beds.
16 beds. In a residential home. So yeah. Is it challenging to find a property that you can convert into 16 bedrooms? That sounds like the biggest question mark, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It is challenging. And even in Arizona, it's challenging to find stuff that we can convert to 10 bedrooms mm-hmm. to make them all private. It's okay to get away with just doing 9 bedrooms or even 8 bedrooms. Like, you know, you don't need to like go essentially all out and try to get all the bedrooms private, because there's not going to be residents who can afford that budget of paying a private room, right? So that's what I always tell, like even the people I mentor and help, is it's not necessary that you get all the bedrooms private. Try to have a combination of the two, probably less semi-private or shared, and more private, but don't be just like fixated on getting it all private. So hopefully that helps some of the listeners too.
How are you guys coming up with the equity for these deals? Are you guys raising money from investors?
We are syndicating all of our deals, yeah.
Okay.
And I know you like doing debt partnerships, right? Like that's what you focus. And we've done that on our behavioral facility, the 20 bed. We just brought on two debt partners on that one.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. Very cool.
But we do equity partnerships on all of our deals.
506B, 506C?
506Bs.
Okay.
Yeah. And I know people have opinions on the two, but I personally like the 506Bs a lot more. Yeah.
I do too. I don't like telling people no. And I also think it's cool to, you know, when friends, family, people that are non-accredited can participate with your deals. And so I think that is kind of a cool aspect. You know, early on, we were talking before we started recording, like I didn't realize that you could buy real estate using other people's money, you know, and it's such a powerful tool to utilize if you know what you're getting into and you know what you're doing. But I would suggest learn either via mentorship or find someone that's done it, go partner with them or go do your first couple of deals with your own money before you start raising money from others.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was one thing, like I was telling you when we were talking before, you know, it was just one relationship that changed my whole trajectory in real estate investing. And that was my business partner now. And he was syndicating. And to your point is you find somebody that's already doing it, bring them value. And like I was telling you, it was kind of like a key to lock situation. I had the network of operators, knowing the regulations, knowing the operation side of it, right? And that was the value I brought to the table. It wasn't like, oh yeah, let me just partner up with you and try to just ride along. It was like, I wanted to bring value. And there was a period of time there in the beginning where I did feel like I wasn't doing enough because I didn't know all the info, right? I didn't even know what a syndication was before him and I partnered up. And for like the first year and a half, dude, it was just like, am I doing enough? Am I pulling my weight? And it was a lot of that because I was in my head too. And I was just trying to figure it out as I went. And there was a lot of like learning curve to it. But at the same time, it's you got to go through that. You got to be willing to put yourself in that position and just understand that like if you just stay consistent and keep learning deal after deal, because each deal, as you know, is so different. You're dealing with so many different types of personalities, right? And especially in ours, like with what we do, we have the operator. And on top of that, we have what we're dealing with the seller, right? And we're dealing with the current operation that's in place, right? And there's just a lot of like moving pieces and it can go south really quickly and it can go well really quickly. And I wanted to ask you this. Have you had a deal where it didn't work out the way you thought it was going to?
Yeah.
Even after you closed, like did it just not operate the way you thought it was going to operate?
Almost every deal.
Really?
Yeah, almost every deal. I'll give you an example. The 32 unit multifamily deal that I bought with a couple partners early on back in Indianapolis, as soon as we closed on that one, we had a bunch of tenants move out unexpectedly. We had a challenging property management company that we were utilizing. COVID dropped while we're like in the middle of like renovating all these units. And so we were sitting at like 65% occupancy right when the pandemic dropped and there was all these stay at home orders. We're like, holy cow, guys, like how are we going to fill these units? And so that was, you know, a challenge to begin with. The first 11 unit property I bought out in Cincinnati, as soon as it closed on that one, like four of the 11 tenants moved out. I had hired the wrong property manager, like from the jump. And so like 6 weeks in, I was in a position to where I was like, holy cow, I got to find another property manager. And so I had to fire her and bring another one in. And so I think most deals I've done, there's been unexpected things that pop up after close.
Yeah.
But it's not what happens to you, it's more so how you deal with these issues once they happen. You got to be solution-based and solution-oriented to navigate all these different angles and things that are thrown at you, because in all reality, you know, you plan for the worst and hope for the best, and there's going to be curveballs thrown at you. And it's not just real estate investing, it's business. I'm growing, I'm learning every day, but I wouldn't trade it for anything, right? It's that's how we grow. You know, I believe that things get tough and things get challenging before you level up. And it's true. And that's kind of what I've noticed, at least so far in my path. Learning to become a successful real estate investor can take a lot of time and dedication, which some people just don't have. If you're one of these individuals, this doesn't mean you can't invest in real estate. My company, Summers Capital, is buying a bunch of boutique hotels right now, and you can invest with us in these deals without having to do any of the work. Our team sources the deals, we secure the lending, we take care of all the renovations, and we even handle all the day-to-day operations with our in-house management company, making it truly hands-off and passive for our investors. If you want to learn more to see if we can help you, go to summerscapital.com/invest to book a call with our team. Again, that's summerscapital.com/invest. Now back to the show.
Yeah, and that's one thing I feel like in our space, a lot of that's not talked about because it's not attractive. It's not like the sexy thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Right. And that's one I have a huge challenge of like listening and seeing. And it's like, I love hearing that because I know I've personally gone through that. Just recently, one of our deals, for instance, it was probably either our third or fourth deal that we did. Right before we were closing, our operator pulled out, didn't want to fulfill her obligation on the lease, right? So our earnest is already gone, right? We're so close to closing and there's no way of getting that back. And we're like, well, let's just try to find another operator. Well, we find this other operator, we come to find out that operator is just struggling 6 months later. Right. She's telling us she can't continue moving forward. She's defaulted on her lease. And like thing after thing started popping. At one point, one of the next operator we got in place, they just absolutely failed too. And then they wanted to hold the entity that was tied to that license hostage that we gave to them, essentially.
The lender did?
Our operator.
Mm.
So the license that we held on that facility, there's an entity that's tied to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we gave that entity to that operator just to make the transition a lot smoother. And they held that hostage and would not give it up. And we're like, we need that in order to operate. You guys defaulted. You guys have vacated. You're no longer here. And we brought a new operator in and they're great. But they can't do more things with that license because of that situation. And it was just like thing after thing, right? And
Why did they want to hold the license? What was their benefit of holding it?
They wanted to get more money out of it. They wanted compensation. They're like, you want this so badly? Pay us.
Wow.
And we're like, we gave it to you for free. Like, why would we pay for something we gave to you guys for free? And on top of that, you've defaulted on the lease and you're sent to collections already. Like, let's come to a conclusion here. But no, they're just, greedy, essentially.
What do you guys end up doing?
We have a way around it. Not that they probably even listen to this, but we are still kind of like in the process of getting a new license essentially in there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's like stuff that we have to do on our end to be able to make that happen. But we're fortunate that I consulted with one of my attorneys on it in this space. And she's like, hey, well, you could actually do this. And I'm like, great. That actually works. So that's why it's another good thing to have just good people around you and have a good team of people you trust and attorneys and CPAs, et cetera, people that can advise you mm-hmm. on what you can do if you're in a situation like that and in your situations too, and just having good mentors too. So,
I agree, man. It's like every single deal has something. I was just thinking about it, like the two larger multifamily deals that we syndicated out in the Carolinas with our investors and our co-sponsor out in Charlotte. I mean, both of those deals we bought in 21 on Freddie Mac floaters.
Yeah.
So the intro rate was 2.78 on one of the properties and it was 2.38, I believe, on the other one.
Okay.
We bought 200 basis point interest rate cap to hedge your risk in case the interest rates went up.
Yeah.
We thought there's no way interest rates are going to go up more than 200 basis points. And guess what? They did. And so our debt service on those properties went from, mid-20s a month to like almost 90,000 a month.
Whoa.
Well, there goes all your distributions. There goes all your cash flow. And so, we had to refi both of those deals and, we're closing on the refis right now. Luckily, we are in a position to where we grew the NOI significantly. So we could do refis into, fixed debt. One of the deals we're pulling out a pretty decent chunk of capital. And we're going to be able to return 45 to 50% of the investor capital back and hold the deal. So, but not other operators are in a fortunate position like that, that we got in with these Freddie floaters. And if we were not able to grow the NOI, we would have been in a more challenging position, but luckily we were. So I mean, that's just an example of like every deal is going to have something go a different direction.
Yep.
And it's just all how you navigate it, right?
Absolutely. Did you guys do 506Cs on those ones?
One was a 506B and the next one was a 506C.
How was your guys' investors? Like, how did they react to that? To like, because you guys had to hold distributions.
So we did the 506O with the distributions.
Yeah.
All the investors were like super like understanding. I think all of them were super cool about it. I mean, it is what it is. Things happen. But I think if you communicate and have an open line of communication with your investors, that's what's most important. But they're going to do good in the long run. I mean, both of those deals are going to pan out pretty well in the long run. So we'll see how it all shakes out. We'll see what happens with interest rates. I mean, there's a lot of interesting things that have kind of come to fruition over the last week with the bank collapses. The Fed's got a big meeting next week on Wednesday. You know, a lot of these banks, I think, you know, SVB was one of them, heavy in bonds. Well, when you pump these interest rates up, the prices of these bonds go down. And then when there's a bank run, you got to sell the bonds at a loss. And then you risk a collapse, right? And so I think right now the Fed has a serious question that they need to answer. Are they going to keep battling inflation, or are they going to taper back on the interest rates and prevent maybe future collapses from happening? So it's going to be interesting to see where they go with this.
What's your prediction? Are they going to back the banks, or are they going to continue spiking the interest rates?
Well, it's interesting because I think either way, you know, unfortunately, either way, the American people and the taxpayers are gonna pay for this.
Yep.
Right. If I'm a betting man, I think the Fed's gonna reverse. They're not. I don't think they're gonna do another rate hike here. I think if we see another rate hike, I think they're gonna reverse. I think at a minimum they're going to not raise and maybe they'll go flat. But I wouldn't be shocked if they reverse rates, you know, 25 to 50 basis points.
You think they're gonna reverse?
We'll see. I think the sentiment is they're either going to...
I think you're the first person I've heard say that.
I think most people are thinking they're going to raise by a quarter, like they said, or go flat. Now, if they reverse a quarter in or 50 basis points, it will definitely stimulate the sentiment of the market.
It will. I think you'll see a lot more people trying to be like, let me get in on that now.
Yeah.
And before they increase it. So yeah, it'll be interesting, man. I think
what
the 22nd... So I was having this conversation with my business partner and I'm like, yeah, there's no way they're going to back the banks. There's no way. I think they're just going to go ahead and let the ones that fall, you know, fail. I think I'm on the quarter basis points, like them increasing it a quarter, because I think they still need to keep it under control to some extent.
Well, they already bailed out all the depositors for two bank collapses. Yeah. And so theoretically speaking, if there's other bank collapses that occur, especially even bigger banks, bigger names, they almost have to insure those depositors as well, because how are you gonna back these depositors, but then not, you know, a different bank?
I would hate to be in that position if I was them, to be honest, because there's not one right answer, unfortunately, right? And I think for us, like I was telling my business partner, we're like, we'll just keep buying real estate, you know, like regardless of what comes of that, like what decision they choose to make, it's not going to stop us from doing what we need to do. And I think that's just like a testament to any real estate investor. I think a lot of, like all of the banks we have all of our accounts with, I've got an email from each of our banks. Hey, this is what we have. This is what's going on. You know, we're not over leveraged, or, you know, our balance sheet's looking good, whatever. Right. And we do a lot of business, obviously, with the smaller banks there in Phoenix. But again, one of the things, none of our accounts are over that 250. So I'd be interested to see what their take is on increasing that too, because how long has it been at 250 that they've been insuring 250,000? It's been over a decade, right? That it's been at that limit.
I think that sounds pretty accurate.
And so it'll be interesting what they do there too, because I think a lot of people, it's like, well, dang, I don't want to keep that much money in one account. So they may not be liquidating everything, but I think that trickle effect is going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. When I read the news that it was on Sunday that they were going to bail out all the depositors and insure all the deposits, well, it was like north of 85% of all the deposits were over the 250 mark. When I read that, I realized there's going to be more printing of money long term.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And so, I mean, it's more important than ever, I think. Now, especially, I mean, not trust the banks, get your money out of the banking system, put it into real assets, such as real estate, assets that produce cash flow. assisted living facilities, multifamily, boutique hotels, industrial. Put your money into real assets that produce cash flow, because that long-term, that's the only thing that can be trusted. The dollar can't be trusted. The banking system can't be trusted. Cash is trash. Like that's a proven thing. It's going to be continue to be devalued over time. And so long-term, I think the only thing that's a safe bet, I mean, the stock market can't be trusted. Crypto can't be trusted. Yep. That was such a hot thing a couple of years ago.
It was. I have crypto holdings, but it's such a small percentage of like my cash, right? Because I do believe in diversification, but I also don't believe in like putting all your eggs in one basket either.
Mm-hmm. If you're going to put your eggs in one basket, put it into a good real estate asset class.
Tangible.
But to me, stocks, paper assets, crypto especially, I mean, to me, that's not really investing. It's speculating. You could call it gambling.
Yeah, it is, man. And that was one thing, like, that you got the people who are just hardcore about it, and then you also, and vice versa. But one thing I was really into crypto probably a year, 2 years ago. Even though I still have my holdings and everything, I don't rely on that as like, this is what's going to make me successful. Like, I don't look at that like, oh yeah, I'm going to be, you know, have this crazy Dogecoin run or something, you know? So one thing, obviously doing deals, as much as I've been doing them and everything, it's only proven to me as well, this is where it's at. This is how you truly grow generational wealth. Because yeah, can you go make a few hundred thousand or whatever, a million through maybe crypto? But just like anybody else who wins the lottery, what are you going to do with that afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
Just because you had this lucky streak, or you may have put a few thousand dollars into something and it multiplied. Okay, what's your plan after that? And most people don't have a plan after that. You know, they're working and they're just hoping, right? They're hoping, and that's not investing either. Oh, I'm hoping this will go up. I'm hoping this will pan out.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not investing. Investing is actually looking at numbers, looking at metrics, seeing how things produce. What is it doing for you? How's it working for you? Right. And that's where real estate is just one of those things that you can day in and day out go and look at and see how it's doing for you. I think it's just the best asset. And we may be biased because we do it, but personally, and then you have people who do the operations side, right? And what we do is an operation. Whether people like to call it that or not, it is a business, how we choose to run our real estate portfolios and business. And that's another thing. There is a lot of people who want to get into real estate, but they treat it as like a side hustle. And that's not really a business. That's, yeah, you go buy an asset, but that's about it. And so I think if you're a good operator in general of businesses, you'll always be successful, whether that be to run a syndication firm, whether that be, you know, running an assisted living facility or whatever it may be, right? But if you can run operations and just be good at that, you can ultimately take that in. And that was one thing for me, like I wanted to touch on this, was when I had my assisted living facility. So I don't do operations anymore, for the people that are listening. I don't do that anymore. But the reason being is, so I sold my very first facility last year that I was operating myself. And the reason why I did that was, I realized if I'm going to grow with my business partner, the syndication firm we have, I can't have my focus on two separate things. And I made that decision to go ahead and sell the business. It just made sense, and go all in on our syndication firm. And my business partner, he quit his W-2 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we both just said, let's go all in.
That's the way to do it with almost everything in life. I think when you're doing multiple things, or if you got a backup plan, or you're working a day job and trying to dabble, until you fully commit, your growth is going to be somewhat limited.
Mm-hmm.
And I think life rewards those who go all in.
Yep.
You know, I think society tells us to, and financial advisors tell us from the jump, like, diversify, play it safe. But if you study the real wealthy in our country, all the billionaires out there, like, they earn most of their wealth going all in,
yeah,
on one or two things. And it wasn't until they built all this tremendous wealth in a big team to where they started branching off and doing various things. But in order to get to that one level, they did it by going all in on one or two things.
Yeah, because you see it right now, it's such a popular thing to say, oh, the average millionaire has seven sources of income and this and that. And you do see that a lot, and you hear it a lot too. But to me, everything we've done to this point has all been vertically integrated. Mm-hmm. And like, including my YouTube channel, like, yeah, does that take time and whatever? But that's all vertically. I'm already doing what I'm talking about. So it doesn't take out any effort from me to do it, right? Like, same with your podcast. Like, you're talking about the things you're already doing. And that's really smart if you can vertically integrate and monetize those things as you go. And then that's essentially like, you can say, yeah, that's one source of income. But I kind of keep my online stuff, like, that's just one source of income. And within that one source of income, I, you know, do everything else that I do with the mentorship and whatever. But I just kind of include that all into the online stuff. So yeah, man. And not only that, but like, diversification in real estate too, is really important, right? Having, don't work with just the same lender every time because of the situation with SVB and Signature. It's like, don't just put all your eggs in one basket with one lender. It's great to have that relationship.
For sure.
But that, you got to keep that in mind too. And not only that, but like, one of the things we realized why we kind of shifted from assisted living to behavioral was we didn't want to just be in assisted living. We're like, let's diversify this. Let's, since we're already kind of doing this and it's all kind of within the same space. And on top of that, because we have, so there's this thing called placement in assisted living. So essentially they're placement agents. So think of it as like realtors for the elderly. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a nice way to put it. So we went ahead and integrated that into our business too. And so my wife does that for our business. So we place residents in these facilities we own or other facilities that, if our homes are all full, we'll go ahead and place in these other facilities too. So that's just like another way. I don't know if you, because you have your management company, right? Mm-hmm. And you've vertically integrated. And I think if you can do that within each of your business models that you have or whatever you're doing, it'll help you grow so much quicker too.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more, brother. Well, dude, it's been a pleasure having you on, my man. We'll go ahead and tag all of your info and contact stuff in the show notes. I highly encourage all the listeners to go check out your YouTube channel. You had a good following over there, putting out good content, and excited to connect further with you tonight at our real estate meetup here in downtown San Diego. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. Till next time, peace.